This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Our first guest this morning is senior editor of Scientific American, Josh Fishman. Now, while Josh gets to write about all kinds of interesting topics on how coral reefs are dying and how jellyfish became efficient swimmers, why the big earthquake hit Mexico, and even the science behind new treatment for addiction, this month, July, in Scientific American, he writes about the battle of the brains. No, John, not between men and women. But more importantly, perhaps, between cats and dogs. Now, a bigger brain doesn't necessarily make an animal smarter, but listen in to hear which of our domesticated animals wins the battle of the brains. Josh Fishman, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, Lynn and John. It's a pleasure to be with you. How are things in Park City this morning?
Well, it's a beautiful day in Park City, as well, as it usually is.
I know. I'm jealous. You live in such a great place.
Well, thanks. Glad you like it here. Well, we live in a great place, but you have this great job where you research all kinds of interesting topics before you write about them. Do you pick the topics? How does it work that you come about, you know, writing about anything from jellyfish swimming to dying coral reefs to now telling me that my dog is smarter than my cat?
I really wanted to tell you that your dog is smarter than your cat. That's how I take that topic. And I wanted to tell all my friends that my dog is smarter than their cat. And that's actually a lie, the whole smartness thing. But the topics kind of come out of current research. So I'm talking to scientists to find out what they're doing. I'm reading journals and just trying to keep tabs on the scientific community and finding out what's current, what's new, and what is interesting and important for us to learn about from the scientific world.
And then you bring it, because you're a great writer, you bring it sort of to the lay people so that we can understand it as popular science. And but that said, I mean, getting into your article this month, The Battle of the Brains, I still need some great graphics to kind of grasp what you're talking about here. But let's start off with numbers of cortical neurons and what that tells us about a brain.
Yeah. So let's talk about the cortex, which is the part of the brain that really matters in terms of problem solving. It's actually the newest part of the brain, evolutionarily speaking. It came about with animals who first developed backbones and started getting larger and larger as primates developed and eventually became humans. So it's kind of the area where the stuff that we really think about as thinking happens. And in humans, if you measure it by grams, it's about 2,000 grams. And if you measure it in bears, it's about 200 grams. If you measure it in dogs, it's about 46 grams, and in cats, it's about 24 grams. So there's obviously a difference in size, and what's really interesting is if you can get into the cortex and count the neurons, which work as microprocessors, essentially. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that do the calculating, the problem solving, the analysis, the thinking, and I know John has a computer background, so he can tell you that the more of these things that you can network together, the more powerful your problem solving ability is going to be, at least in the abstract. And so when you compare cats and dogs, are two very popular domesticated animals, what you find out is that, let's see, what are the numbers? Cats, 250 million. Dogs, almost twice as many, 430 million. So that's a big difference.
Yeah, it certainly is, Josh. And I'm just fascinated by so many topics that we cover on Cool Science Radio, but brain science is really grabbed my attention because there's so much that's coming out on almost a weekly basis on all the new studies and those sorts of things. Let's just back up just for a second and talk about what the cortical of neurons or what the cerebral cortex actually is. It's a blanket that sort of lays on top of the brain, and it does a lot of the analysis and decision making that is done in other parts of the brain. Is that what it does?
Yep, exactly. It's sort of like, you know, you can think of your brain as, oh, you know, an orange. The cortex is actually the thin rind on the outside of it.
Mm-hmm.
But in that thin rind are all of these neurons, and that's what we talk about when we, you know, when we talk about the gray matter in the brain, you know, common phrase that we use. Mm-hmm. And so that's where all of the analysis and, you know, imagination and all the things that we normally associate with thinking happen inside the brain. You know, in the interior of the orange, there are areas that do really important stuff that kind of happens and needs to happen automatically, like making sure that you keep breathing and that your blood pressure remains stable.
Exactly.
That sort of stuff.
Exactly. And I think a lot of people have heard, you know, over time, that neurons are very difficult to count, let alone to understand their density and those sorts of things. But there's a very unique thing in your article about how they were able to count this using a laboratory blender and using some specific proteins to mark them. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So the neuroscientist who led this research at Vanderbilt University, her name is Susanna Herculana-Housel, developed a very clever technique for counting neurons because there are different kinds of brain cells. So you can't just, you know, put a brain on a scale and say, okay, that's neurons, because you're including in that count a bunch of different cells that don't do the calculating and the processing that we were talking about earlier. You really want to focus on the neuron. So how do you isolate the neuron? What she did is she, first of all, carefully cut away the cortex of the brain, that outer rind that we were talking about before, and then really put it in a blender. I talked to her. I said, this is like some fancy high-tech piece of laboratory equipment, isn't it? And she said, yeah, it's really just kind of a blender grinder. You know, it's a tube with a blade. And she turns it into a liquid, you know, turns it into a soup. It looks a little bit like unfiltered apple cider. And she joked that her students like won't go near apple cider now.
Don't blame them.
She's just ruined it for them. But so when you've got this broth, it's got neurons floating in it, and you want to fish out just the neurons. And so it turns out that there are molecules that bind specifically to proteins, other molecules, that are only found in the middle of neuron cells. And so what she does is she mixes in some of those marker proteins, or, you know, think of them kind of like fishing line. And they hook the neurons, and only the neurons, and that gives her this count that we were talking about earlier, where she can compare the number of neurons in the brain of a dog to the brain of a raccoon, to the brain of a cat, to a human, or a bear, or a lion.
Okay, so this is why size doesn't matter when it comes to the brain, because there are all these cells in the cortex that don't perform the functions, and those may weigh more. They may create a bigger size around, you know, a bigger cortex, I guess. And it's more these neurons. And once you count them, indeed, you find that, wow, raccoons, they've got the upper hand, 438 neurons found in their cortex. And
438
that kind million. Of explains
million.
What happened.
What did I say? Billion? Okay.
No.
Yeah, it's million. But, well, you know, what's a couple of zeros?
Yeah.
But the point is that for their size, right, raccoons,
yeah.
have, you know, basically got a cat-sized brain. But they've got a dog-sized number of neurons.
Right.
They got the density, don't they?
They sure do, which is why they can figure out how to unscrew the jars in your pantry when they get into your house or your cabin.
Has that happened to you, Lynn?
No, but I have seen, and now that you mention it, raccoons have come into, you know, a camp that I've been in before. And it is amazing. They can take the... You know, instead of tearing up the loaf of bread, the plastic wrapper, they can take the little, you know, thing off the thing. I can't think of what it's called. But, you know, the little wire around the loaf of bread.
Mm-hmm.
They can just take that off. They do it all very neatly.
They're just amazing problem solvers. My next door neighbor, Sarah, has been involved in this year-long war against a raccoon that lives in our backyard and keeps going into her garbage, not mine for some reason. I guess we don't eat as many great things. But, you know, she has gone from different kinds of garbage cans to putting bungee cords across them and different kinds of bungee cords, and the raccoons keep getting in, and she's now gotten to a padlock. You know, she's actually drilled a padlock and hasp onto her garbage can. And I'm like walking by every night looking at it, expecting to see a raccoon with a little lockpick set.
Yeah, exactly. That is
because
great.
Because they already have that burglar mask face. You know, they need a lockpick set.
Yeah, of course. I love it. So raccoons then have the 438 million neurons, which is more than a dog that would have a larger brain. Again, why size doesn't matter. But what you also give in your article an explanation about density of these neurons. And in the case of the raccoon, it's very dense, their neurons, even more dense than in the brain of a human. So what does that
right.
have
and
to
that
do
can with? Be, and that can be misleading.
Okay.
You really want to focus on number rather than density because, you know, raccoons are very clever, but you and I know that they just, you know, they didn't build the pyramid.
Yeah.
So they don't do things that humans do with their brains. So it's not just density. You know, the overall size matters as well. You know, density is sort of the measure of the number of neurons in a particular unit. So it's like, you know, how many neurons can you pack into a brick? Well, you can pack a lot of neurons into a brick, but if you only have a couple of bricks, that's not a lot of neurons. But if you got a whole wall or a building of bricks, that's a lot. So humans have a lot. You know, we've got brickheads. And dogs have more neurons, and again, when you have a larger number of these things overall, you get to network them together into neural networks that overall have more processing and problem-solving power than just a fewer number of neurons, even though they're densely packed. Because if you want to look at like real densely packed neurons, you could look at like voles or shrews. And Susanna, the scientist, told me, you know, if we were just looking at density, you know, the voles would be running the world because they've just got a lot packed into a very tiny space. But it's the, you know, size does matter.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Josh Fishman. He's the senior editor at Scientific American. He's wrote a whole bunch of different articles. You can go to Scientific American, and then within their search facility, just search on Josh Fishman and look at all the articles that he's written. Lots of fascinating stuff. You know what intrigues me is some of the new science that's coming out about how the subconscious brain can override the conscious brain. Now, obviously, the subconscious brain is doing stuff while you're sleeping, doing stuff constantly, you know, keeping you breathing, working on proteins, all the different things that does communication within the cells and all of the organs. But they say that the subconscious brain, in some of the new studies, is like 80 to 85% of all decisions are made by that brain. Do you know very much about that, Josh?
I know a little bit about that, or my subconscious brain knows a little bit about that. It will inform my conscious brain in the course of forming the sentence as I dredge stuff up from memory. And that's kind of how it works. You know, there are things that are going on below your consciousness. Your consciousness, a really smart neuroscientist named Christoph Koch once described it to me as a spotlight, sort of an intentional spotlight. And so imagine a floodlight or a spotlight that is shining into the darkness, and it shines in one particular area, and then it moves to another particular area, and that's your consciousness. You know, that's sort of like the little bit that's in your awareness at a particular situation. But there's all of this surrounding area that's dark for the moment. And it's not in your, you know, it's not in the forefront of your attention, but it's still there. And all of these neuron networks, the things that we've been talking about, reach into those parts of the brain and can connect to them and bring the memories that are stored there into this conscious area. And the whole thing is very fluid. It moves around. So there are a lot of influences that your subconscious brain can have on your conscious brain. And that's why it's important when you talk about smartness or intelligence to talk about different domains of intelligence or smartness, because, you know, you can have kind of a mathematical smartness. You know, you could be great at solving number problems or writing Scientific American articles. But there's another kind of intelligence that is physical intelligence, right? That you can see that in Olympic athletes.
Exactly.
And that counts too, and is important. And so some kinds of animals are better at that than maybe humans are. You know, certainly if you've ever seen a chimpanzee navigating its way through a forest canopy, they do that a lot better than I would do it.
Right.
So some people say that you can consciously decide that you want to do a certain thing, but your subconscious brain can possibly override it because they think that maybe a different path is in your best interest. And the other day I'm playing golf. I'm on a par three. There's water right in front of the pin, and I decide I'm going to go for the pin. I'm going to take the risk. There's, you know, this chicken flats on the left-hand side, we call it, because it's where you bail out and you don't have to go over as much water.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot easier. And every time I aim for the pin, that ball goes into chicken flats. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. And I'm thinking that my subconscious brain has decided, hey, listen, you know, you're not that good a golfer. It's in your best interest to go out to chicken flats.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy.
That's a really, really interesting example. Like, your subconscious brain could be wired into some kind of memory of what's happened the last 50 times that you've tried to make it over that water hazard. And you know, the last 50 times you've hooked right or hooked left. And, you know, and it said, you know, we know the results of this. Let's not do that again.
I love it. Okay, I've got one for you as well. And this happened to me just last night. You know how we often solve problems in our dream state? So that's our subconscious mind working while we're asleep. And it happens to me about once a month. I've long loved the study of language. And last night, I was dreaming away about how I was having a conversation in Italian. Now, I can get along in Italian, you know, mostly when I'm in Italy after a couple glasses of vino rosso. But I don't really speak it very well. And yet in my dream, I was. And I was coming up with words that I had sort of known at some point, but, you know, they weren't brought, you know, they're not in the forefront of my brain. And I have been very fascinated about that, about bringing something that you know that you don't really know that you know. It's kind of like that muscle memory, bringing it forth. So there's my little mm-hmm. unconscious brain story.
So when you woke up, did you remember any of those words?
No, but I'm sure I will if I just go to Italy and have those couple glasses of red wine. And yeah, mm-hmm. But you know,
and I've always heard that if you wake up from a dream and write down
yes
what you remember from the dream right away, you know, that's sort of the only way to keep it, because it kind of gets wiped from your conscious working memory very quickly. You know, once you sort of get into the day, you make coffee, hit the showers, you know, lots of other things are going on.
Right.
So you've got to, like, raise your head from the pillow, and the first thing you do is, like, reach for a pad and paper and, you know, write down the Italian word for bring me more wine.
Exactly. Right. And that sort of solidifies this learning that may go on in your dream state. And also it kind of brings up what our conscious mind, sort of the filters that it may have. And, you know, we talk about the cortex as being analytical, the analytical part of your brain. Perhaps it sort of hijacks or trumps your unconscious brain and the knowledge that you already have there because of some affective filter, something that you have.
There's... Yeah, and then, you know, there are a lot of, sometimes I think of the brain as, and this is just a metaphor, but, you know, it's kind of like this crowd of different people in a room, and there's somebody standing on top, but there are all these other people competing for attention, and sometimes, like, the emotional brain gets the attention. Sometimes the analytical brain gets the attention. Sometimes the physical pole vault jumping brain or golf playing part of the brain gets the attention. You know, it kind of gets noisy in there. You remember that movie that came out a couple of years ago, Up, I think it was called?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And there's I think I'm thinking of the right movie. There was a kid who had all of these different kinds of emotions in her brain, competing for attention, represented by different characters, different colors. Am I thinking of the wrong movie?
I don't really remember. I don't think I even saw the movie. Anyway.
But it is interesting.
Anyway.
And I believe that there's some work being done in addiction behavior as well. We had a guest on our show a little while ago, Annie Grace. She wrote this book, The Naked Mind, about people that wanted some help quitting alcohol for whatever reason they wanted to quit. And one of the things that she said in it was that the conscious brain can understand so many frames per second when it's watching TV, and it's not many frames at all. But the subconscious brain can grab all the frames, tens of thousands per second. It has the capacity for understanding. And that the conscious brain may see these commercials of two young people walking into a beautifully lit bar, and everyone's smiling, and the guy gets the girl, and they're having a cocktail, and everybody's happy. And the subconscious brain sort of grabs that and holds on to it. The conscious brain is saying, hey, you know, I want to lose some weight, so I want to cut back or quit alcohol for some reason. And that's where the subconscious doesn't, you know, the two don't get the memo, where the conscious wants to do something. The subconscious has all of these things that sort of pushes the person in the direction to continue imbibing alcohol. So so there, apparently it's being used in other addictive behavior therapy. So it's
right.
just
there's
interesting
an,
stuff.
There's, it's fascinating stuff. There's an area deep in the brain called the amygdala, which is where a lot of very primal emotions and responses to emotions are located, things like fear and joy of reward. And those really come into play. Those areas are stimulated by addictive drugs or alcohol. And that stimulation can be very powerful. And like you were saying, there can be another part of your brain saying, I don't want to do this. But the signals coming out of the amygdala are basically a fire hose, and they're very powerful, and they can override conscious, rational thought with this very primordial drive saying, go ahead, do it.
Yeah. Well, the article is Battle of the Brains. It's in this month's Scientific American. And, you know, at the end of the day, as your friend, the researcher, Susanna Herculano Housel says, you should love your pet no matter how many neurons are in its cortex, which really brings it all back, right?
Yep. You know, and I have a lovely, lovely dog, and there are days when I actually don't think she's got a lot of neurons in her cortex. And there are other days that it seems like she's smarter than I am. And I just, I love her on both of those days.
Very good. Well, Josh Fishman, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. We'll look forward to our next talk with you.
Let's do it again soon, Lynn. This has been a lot of fun.
All right. Thanks, Josh. Sounds good. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye, Lynn and John.